And good evening and welcome to Tom Harris USA, episode number 78. This is Tom Harris in beautiful Chicago, Illinois. And it is absolutely gorgeous right now. The spring has arrived in earnest, and we now have leaf buds on the trees. We have lots of flowers, and it is turning into a very, very nice early spring. Lots of road work going on. Interestingly enough, I did mention a couple of shows ago that they're doing some work in the alleyway behind my building, and that is ongoing. They put in some new electrical boxes, and they have now been protected, as I had expressed concern about before. They have been protected by the sort of metal cabinet sort of things. But now they're doing some other work, and I'm not sure if this is directly related to it or not. But they are digging a trench down the middle of the alley, which may affect traffic for a few days. And I don't know what they're doing back there right now. So it does look interesting, though. And in addition to that, they're also doing a lot of work in the middle of the road. And I think I mentioned before that the water mains here in Chicago run underneath the roadways. The problem with that is that during the winter, you have a lot of expansion and contraction because of freezing and ice. And that usually causes cave-ins in the road, and you get potholes. And that has been a persistent problem, and especially in this neighborhood, because our alderman really doesn't give a crap about actually providing services for this neighborhood. He's more interested in making deals with developers to make a lot of money. So it is a big problem, but they're trying something new here, and it sounds interesting, and I'm wondering how well it'll work. But they're doing something like angioplasties on the water mains here in my neighborhood and trying to prevent these collapses from happening. And it seems that what they're doing is they're actually like putting silicon linings on the inside of these pipes, and they're sort of, you know, pumping the silicon in like a balloon, like you said, like an angioplasty. And they're hoping that this will actually prevent these road collapses. I'm sure they've got to be expensive to fix. And as time goes on, more and more happen because they haven't obviously replaced these water mains under the street other than spot repairs for a very long time. And I think they're hoping to save a little bit on road repairs. So I guess we'll see what happens. It has been interesting to kind of watch the work. And considering that this is City of Chicago utilities people, they're being remarkably efficient about this, and they're not disrupting the neighborhood very much, which is a good thing. Anyway, I have a couple of audio comments this week, and this is in regards to the discussion that we've been having on political bias and that sort of thing. And I have a fairly short comment from Scott, and then I also have a comment from Trucker Tom. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to play the shorter one first and then have a few comments to make on that before moving on to Tom's clip. So let's get right to it. Here is Scott Mitchell from the Scott Podcast.
Hi, Tom. Comments on a couple of your latest podcasts here in rapid fire order. I'm starting on, I just now started on the very latest, and I've got to say, kind of working in my way in reverse order, that the microphone once again sounds clear. Something you did a while back, I don't know if you changed the mic or I don't remember what it was, but all of a sudden you were not as crisp and clear as you were before.
Just interjecting here for a second, that was because I switched over from the USB headset mic to a clip-on external mic, and I was not really happy with the sound of that, and that's why I've gone to a more expensive sort of professional broadcasting mic, which is what I'm using now. So thank you, Scott.
Before that, you were talking about conspiracy theories in my comment, which you paraphrased. You didn't play it. And that's fine, by the way. You know, if you will quote my remarks accurately, and I think you do, so far as I've heard, then I don't have a big problem with you doing that. And frankly, I don't need to listen to myself. Usually when I come on the podcast, I just go skip, 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 because I already know what I see. You were saying on conspiracy theories, I was saying that how I watch, you know, what people do as opposed to what they say. And I was saying, you know, you're coming off as less of a middle grounder, and you're saying, well, I'm not a total middle grounder. I lean this way and that way.
And I do want to interject here. And when you talk about being a middle grounder, I don't think this is the same thing as when I say that I'm a political moderate, because I still think of myself as a political moderate. Now, on some issues, I lean more to the right, and on some issues, I lean more to the left. But overall, I'm still somewhere in between. And you'll find some issues like healthcare, for example, where my position could be considered very much on the left. And that really doesn't have anything to do with a left-right orientation. That has to do with doing what's right and working for the common good, the best thing for everyone involved. And you consider yourself a middle grounder. Now, the danger I see in holding a sort of a middle ground position towards everything is when you get into, you know, fairly clear-cut cases of a particular position being clearly wrong, such as the example of torture. I mean, obviously, if you want to assume that, you know, the right-wing position is that torture is okay and that the extreme left-wing position is that torture is wrong, I wouldn't agree with that paradigm. And if the middle ground is to say, well, a little bit of torture is okay, or torture is bad, but we have to do it anyway, you know, I don't consider that a tenable situation. I think torture is clearly wrong, and it's illegal. And I used the oversimplistic example. You know, you have the people who think that 2 plus 2 equals 4, and then you have people that think that 2 plus 2 equals 6, and you don't want to take sides, you know, because heaven forbid you should actually take a stand on something. So the middle ground approach is to say, well, okay, well, I can see both of your points of view, but I'm going to choose in between, and I'm going to say that 2 plus 2 equals 5. And that's still a wrong position. And that was sort of the point of what I was saying in the last episode.
Then you were talking about conspiracy theories, and you were saying that from what you can see, the right seems to be more suspicious of the government than the left. And maybe that's why they have more conspiracy theories. Well, as regards conspiracy theories that involve our government and a one world order and things like that, I guess I would tend to agree with that, because I've actually noticed that myself. You know, there probably are a lot more of those kind of right-wing conspiracies than there are from the left. You know, saying that the opposite way around, you would say that the liberal side of things, or the left side of things, is more trusting of government than the right is. And I think that shows, because that's something that the right has always disliked about the left, is the fact that they say that they're, you know, they build up bureaucracy and make for larger and larger government and government running everything, and that they trust the government too much. And, you know, there's a little of that in me too. I got to be honest with you. I don't like a whole lot of government. I'm more libertarian. And you say in certain respects you are too. And I would say that when it comes to government, I am probably more libertarian than I am, or more, maybe even more conservative, if you will. But I don't think even conservatives have done a great job at limiting government. I think I've described the extent to which I'd like government in my podcast that I always refer to, which was Christian communism, that I'd like to have a government kind of based on that philosophy, even though, as I've said many times, that philosophy is not based on religion. I only use the word Christian. It could better have been called moral communism or something to that effect, because it wasn't about Christianity. And it really isn't about communism. It was about that, well, you have to listen to the podcast, but it was, you know, it was about morality. It was kind of about living the way that Jesus would have had us live, whether you believe in Jesus or God or anything else. If you look at the example, can you really find a problem with that kind of way of living life? Doesn't it say it all? You know, on one hand, you know, it says, you know, you should take care of the poor. You know, the part that was missing from the Bible is the part that says that if somebody takes care of you, though, you should do everything in your power to earn it. And that's the part that isn't there as much in the Bible as I would like. And I guess that might be, I don't know what part you would call that in my philosophy. But I'm getting off track here. I do that too easily. So, yeah, I would tend to agree with what you said there. I just want to point out that that's a dual-edged sword. That, you know, it may be that there are less conspiracy theories that have to do with government and one world order and all that. But at the same time, that is actually the fact that the left trusts government more can actually be a bad thing, because that means they are perfectly willing to give us more of it, and I'm not in favor of that, and I don't think that that's a good thing. As regards art, you know, I was listening to that whole discussion about art, and you came to one part that I think's always been kind of an interesting issue to me, the idea of our, again, the government making us pay for art. And you're saying it's short-sighted and, you know, art has to stand on its own and what a horrible thing that is and so on. Some people think that the heyday of art is way back when. And way back when, we didn't have government supporting art, did we? Did we have, you know, the people being, well, you might say that they did. The kings, you know, took money from the people and hired it to make art and all that sort of thing. But I don't think the people liked it. So if you can point out a point in history where people willingly allowed money to come out of their pay, you know, by the government, you know, and they loved it, and it was a great age for art. You know, there may be some little period back there, but I don't know where it is.
Okay, I'm going to interject again here because I think you're kind of right on the edge of misinterpreting my remarks. And I don't think that I described my feelings about it all that well in the actual podcast. But the idea of forcing people to pay for art is not what I'm for. There is a lot of good that can come from government or governments giving grants for the creation of art. And it goes all the way back to the Renaissance. It goes back to, you know, people like Da Vinci. Now, Da Vinci would not have been able to sell his art in the marketplace, at least not on a level that would allow him to make a living at it. There simply wasn't the market for it. The idea, you know, you look back and you look at all of the beautiful buildings and you think, look at, you know, the masterpieces of the world. Who paid for those? In the context of the discussion that I was having with Robert in Iceland, and we were talking about architecture mainly, and I brought up the fact that a lot of the works that we really look at as being architectural masterpieces, you know, masterpieces of craftsmanship, a lot of that stuff was paid for by the government, by the taxpayer, during the Great Depression. And you look at this golden age of architecture and beautiful buildings being created and these Art Deco masterpieces that you see in downtown Chicago. A lot of that is the result of the WPA and organizations like that, that were government programs created to keep people working. And they were jobs programs of the 1930s. And you had to keep the stonemasons working. You had to keep all these craftsmen working, the bricklayers working. So there was an unprecedented amount of construction going on in the 1930s because of things like the WPA. And we have masterpieces of architecture to show for this. And of course, there were hardcore fiscal conservatives who opposed these sorts of programs. But these things passed because it was widely seen as being vital to the good of the country to have these stonemasons and people have jobs and to keep the economy moving in a time when the economy was very, very poor, much worse, in fact, than it is today. These public works programs were the stimulus packages of their day, and they worked. So I think that it is short-sighted just to say, well, I don't think that the government should be paying for art under any circumstances. At the same time, obviously, you don't want to put the government in charge of art. I mean, that would just be silly. And I do apologize, Scott, because I have edited you heavily here in the second part of this comment. When you're talking about not wanting to pay for art and every bit of the art, and that's never how it's worked. You know, the amount of art that gets paid for through the National Endowment for the Arts and so forth is actually a very small amount. It's not like people are making a living off these government grants. Usually they're pretty small grants, and they make a lot of them. And these things go to a lot of different types of artists, and it goes to things like theaters, a lot of the regional theaters, like the Guthrie Center in Minneapolis, or probably even some of the theaters that you've been to in New York City. You imagine most of those have NEA grants for various productions. And it is a very complicated thing, and I'm not going to get into it because I've got another comment to get to here. But, you know, not all art should be paid for by the government, obviously. That would kind of be a straw man situation. Now, as far as Robert Mapplethorpe, I'm just going to very briefly mention this. You know, there was a big controversy made over the exhibition that was made in Cincinnati. I think it was in the latter part of the 1980s. But one thing that is not being accurately reported in that whole situation is that this was a photographic exhibition of 600 photos. And of those 600 photos, only 20 of them or so, it was a very small percentage, tiny percentage, were considered to be controversial. The rest of them were fine art photos of things like flowers. And you can always do a Google search. Look up Mapplethorpe flowers. And you will see some of these photos. And they're absolutely magnificent. The man was a genius. And you can't diminish everything that he's done based on a few erotic photos that may not have been to your taste. And I think this is why, you don't want to have the government in charge of saying what's art and what's not. But I do see that government funding for art is a good thing. However, like you said, not paying for every bit of art. But government doesn't do that anyway. The NEA doesn't do that. They don't fund all of everything. They don't, they give little bits here and there to, usually it's for specific projects. So like you say, you have a Rembrandt exhibit that's traveling across the country. The NEA may give a grant for that project. Or perhaps a documentary being made on the Civil War. The NEA will give a grant for that project. And I don't see anything wrong with that. It certainly isn't a situation where people are actually making a living off of these grants. All right, time to move on. Sorry about that, Scott. I didn't mean to edit you so heavily, but I have a longer comment here from Tom Wiles, also known as Trucker Tom. So take it away, Tom.
Hey, Tom. This is Tom Wiles, a.k.a. Trucker Tom. I was listening to your latest podcast and kind of asking for comments. You were commenting on a comment that Scott had sent you where he had kind of suggested that you do come across as sort of having a bit of a left-leaning bias. And I'm going to play an example of portion of your last podcast that's what gives me the impression that you have, that you kind of lean to the left.
As much as the Republicans would love to peg Barack Obama as a socialist, he's not. In fact, I would say that if anybody who says that Barack Obama is a socialist doesn't know anything about either Barack Obama or about socialism.
Well, now let me interrupt. Now we need to define our terms. This is from Wikipedia, which on some things are good and some things you gotta be careful about, but the socialism definition seems to be fairly comprehensive. So this is from Wikipedia. Socialism refers to the various theories of economic organization which advocate either public or direct worker ownership and administration of the means of production and allocation of resources. Let's kind of look at what has happened with Barack Obama. Not what Barack Obama says or caught up in the emotional rhetoric. What has happened? Well, General Motors, the government owns them at this point. That's been nationalized. You can think of General Motors and Chrysler as being at least partially nationalized.
I just wanted to interrupt for a second in regards to GM. Now, it is true that the U.S. government owns now a sizable portion of voting stock in General Motors. But without that, General Motors would have gone under completely. Keep also in mind that the government of Canada owns something like 15% of General Motors. So if it's nationalized, what country owns it? No, I mean, it's not a good example, Tom, and I have to say there are a lot better examples that you can give out there of nationalization. But I honestly believe, and I think that there is certainly precedent for this, is that if McCain had been elected, the same thing would have happened. And I think the precedent that you can look at is the bailout of Chrysler in the 1980s under Ronald Reagan. And you could argue that this kind of the same thing happened then. There's a lot of strings attached to these these loans or, you know, this buyout or whatever you want to call it of GM. It isn't sort of a sweetheart deal for the U.S. government. All of a sudden, the U.S. government is creating cars and controlling the means of production. GM is still a publicly traded company. They are still in business for a profit. And I believe that the deal is that the U.S. government is going to sell the stock back to GM as their situation improves financially. That is how I understand that this deal to have worked. That doesn't sound like nationalization to me.
The same thing is happening with healthcare. They're trying to pass this bill, and it's their stated goal. They've stated it over and over again, including Barack Obama, that they want a single-payer system with the government being the single payer for healthcare. They have the stated goal of destroying the health insurance industry.
Just interjecting again, you say that many people, including Barack Obama, have said that their goal is to create a single-payer system. If that is the case, then why have they not created a single-payer system? And I suppose that, you know, it would tie in also with this whole idea of somehow universal health care being socialistic. I suppose that you could argue it's socialistic with a small s. However, that's not how the word socialism is used in the political discourse that's going on. Socialism is being used in the political discourse as a synonym for communist. Now, obviously, there's a lot of countries out there, including countries like Japan, probably, you know, the most capitalist country you can think of. They're not a communist country, yet they have universal health care. Now, I also want to point out here that Barack Obama has not ever stated that his goal was to destroy the health insurance industry. And as a matter of fact, this current new law that has been enacted is going to require that people buy private health insurance. There is no public option. So how is that going to destroy the health insurance industry? And I want to point out that private health insurance companies do quite well in places like Sweden and Japan and the UK. So there's really no danger of them going out of business. Even if we had universal health care, which we don't have, and which has really not even been proposed seriously.
Now that is socialist. I'm sorry. Can't listen to the rhetoric. The rhetoric is emotional, and they'll say politicians will often say what they think the audience wants to hear. You've got to look at what they do. The actions that Barack Obama has taken really indicate to me that he's a socialist.
All right, so you make a good point here about not listening to the rhetoric and looking at what people do. And, you know, that's what I'm doing. This is what I'm doing. I'm looking at what people are doing. And what Barack Obama has done, well, he bailed out GM. Well, Ronald Reagan bailed out Chrysler. So it's not like Ronald Reagan was this big socialist for bailing out Chrysler. Then you're talking about healthcare, and you're talking about Barack Obama wanting to destroy the health insurance industry. And that, my friend, is rhetoric. I've looked extensively online, could not find any quote from Barack Obama talking about how he wants to destroy the insurance industry. Found plenty of rhetoric from healthcare opponents that claim that, but nothing from the man himself. So now we're not even talking about something that he actually said. We're talking about words being put into his mouth. We're clearly not in factual territory anymore. We're in opinion and rhetoric. And I just wanted to point that out, because as much as you can say, well, Barack Obama is a socialist because he wants a single-payer system, he has not enacted a single-payer system. And not only that, but if you want to make the argument that he wants to destroy private health insurance, the new system not only does not destroy private health insurance, it actually requires people to buy private health insurance. How does that make sense? So this is not a matter of believing rhetoric. This is actually looking at what he has done as opposed to what he has said or what other people have said that he's said. And this goes back to what I was saying a few episodes ago when I was talking about political bias. Work through it logically.
I'm sorry, but I'm looking at the facts of what he's done and what he's actually advocated and advocating, where the policies will lead, as opposed to what the man says.
But isn't it interesting how the media is full of people talking about Barack Obama and his socialist agenda? The mainstream media is reporting this, and the people calling Obama a socialist aren't people on the fringes. These are the Republican leaders in the Senate and the House. These are our mainstream politicians. Whereas there were very, very few people who were calling George W. Bush a Nazi. And those who were people on the fringes. You didn't hear that kind of disrespect on the floor of the Senate or the floor of the House of Representatives. Make of that what you will. This is sort of the hyperbole and the exaggeration and trying to convince the people on the other side that 2 + 2 really does equal 6. And the stronger you are pushing, you know, towards these positions, the more inflammatory the rhetoric, the more obvious it is who the Sixers are here.
So overall, right or wrong, fair or unfair, you kind of come across as always sort of defending the Democrats, kind of defending sort of the left wing position. And again, that's just my perception, and I think it's also Scott's perception. I make no bones about it. I tend to be conservative. I do have a conservative bias. You know, I know that. And I don't try to pretend that I don't. You know, I try to be as open-minded as possible. But then again, I am a conservative. And I do have that bias. And I make no bones about it. I tell people that right up front. And, you know, I'm going to just state that right up front. And then I'm going to make my points. And then I'm going to try to explain why I think the way I do. I think it's somewhat disingenuous when people say, oh, I'm in the middle, I'm not biased, I have no biases, you know, I'm just trying to go for the facts, and so on and so forth, but then they won't admit what their bias is, because we're all biased. I don't care who you are, you're biased. And, you know, I think it's better and it's less disingenuous to admit that bias right up front before you start going and out and looking for facts or trying to identify what the facts are. Because if you won't admit that bias to yourself, whatever the bias is, then you're sort of really maybe lying to yourself. Your view is really the right one, and that's going to end up skewing what you believe the facts to be. Some people, you can put facts right in front of their face. I've seen this over and over again. You can put facts right in front of their face, and they will ignore them. And I've seen that happen on the left and the right. In any case, you can find me at TruckerTomPodcast.com. I'm enjoying the show. Keep up the great work. We'll catch you later.
And thank you, Tom, for your contribution. It's always good to hear from you, sir. And if anybody else wants to contribute to the discussion, they're always welcome to. The email address for the program is tom@tomharrisusa.com. So I just wanted to raise another couple points before closing out the show, because it's getting kind of low on time here. So on the idea that everybody is biased, I think there's some truth in that. I think that in order to have an opinion, you have to, by definition, take a position. And I think that you need to actually create your stands on issues based on the facts and not the rhetoric. And this is one of the things that has come up a lot. And I think that political entertainment media, whether it's, you know, it's Randy Rhodes on the left or Rush Limbaugh on the right or whoever, that people, I think, way too often believe uncritically what they're fed. And I think you see that especially in a lot of these protests, where it's very clear that these people can't even answer basic questions about their own position. And when it comes to people like, you know, the Corbett Report and Alex Jones and, you know, the sort of conspiracy theorists who are just putting these crazy ideas out there, it does make you wonder as to how far people will take this. Do your own research. And I know I sound like a broken record about this, but it's something I strongly believe. It's really easy to debunk a lot of this stuff. It's simple. All you need to do is actually look at real news articles. In the case of science-related stories, scientific journals and scientific articles. It's not that hard to do, but a lot of people don't bother doing it because it requires effort, and people want to be spoon-fed their opinions. And that goes for a lot of people on the left as well as the right. Anyhow, I'm all out of time, so I'm going to go ahead and close out the show. Thanks for listening. As always, this is Tom in Chicago, Illinois, signing off. We'll see you next time.